Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Wyckoff, New Jersey, and earned a BA in political science from St. Lawrence University. From 1991 to 96, she was a business news correspondent and anchor for the Wall Street Journal Report. In 2004, she joined Fox News Channel, and since 2017, she's been the anchor/executive editor of The Story with Martha McKellum. She's the author of Unknown Valor, a story of family, courage, and sacrifice from Pearl Harbor to Iwo Jima. Her name, Martha McKellum. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula, this is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the anchor/executive editor of The Story with Martha McKellum. Martha McKellum. Martha, welcome, an honor to have you.
Oh, Jack, it's great to be with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Oh, well, thank you. You know what? I had a wonderful childhood, and I had a wonderful mom and dad. I just lost my dad recently, actually. He was 92, and we were very close. My dad would always send me, you know, text messages, you know, softly suggesting, like, you know, someone should ask Vice President Vance this, you know? So he was really so sharp until the very end. So I'm just grateful for our friendship and for my mom and my dad. I lost my mom when she was 78 to breast cancer, so about a little more than 12 years ago. But I treasure them so much. And I feel like the older I get, the more you realize, you know, how much your parents worried about you, because I worry about my kids all the time now, and thought about your life and, you know, enjoyed your successes and all of it. But, you know, I'm one of three girls. I have two older sisters, and we were raised in Wyckoff, but we moved around. We were in Chicago. We were in Maryland. My dad worked for IBM, which used to be, you know, back then people used to call it I've Been Moved, because they loved to move the executives around to different offices around the country. So my dad was in New York on Madison Avenue toward the end of his career, but we moved a bunch growing up, which I always thought was kind of a fun adventure. It didn't bother me. I liked, you know, sort of landing in a new neighborhood as a little kid and making friends and seeing different parts of the country. So I enjoyed that. And we spent our, you know, every summer we would spend a week or two in Cape Cod, because my mom's side grew up. My grandfather, I should say, was from Worcester, Massachusetts. And so that side was very kind of New England oriented and went up to the Cape in the summer. So we would rent, you know, a tiny little cottage with my grandparents, both sides, because my mom and dad were both only children. So we have a small family, and we would all go up there and rent these tiny little cottages and lots of pine needles on the ground. And it was idyllic because it was simple, and we looked forward to a big lobster dinner that we would cook at home at the end. And so those are just really, really special memories for me. I had very solid grandparents as well. So I attribute any sense of, you know, sort of integrity and joyfulness and focus on family to that whole upbringing. It was really nice. You don't realize it at the time, but when you get older and you see the struggles that some people have and have to overcome in terms of that their family setup, we were pretty lucky in that regard.
You got a political science degree from St. Lawrence University. Martha, you've had a fabulous career in journalism. What inspired you to pursue this field?
You know, ever since I was young, I was always interested in what was going on. And back then, you know, the news meant watching the 6 o'clock news with your family. And one of my earliest memories of something big that was going on were the Watergate hearings. And my older sister, Jane, was always very curious and interested in politics. So I remember as a little kid, you know, in the summer, sitting there on the floor and watching these Watergate hearings with her. I think I was about six, maybe. And she explained all the players to me, John Dean and Ehrlichman and all of the players, Martha Mitchell, George Mitchell. And I just thought it was a story that kind of sucked me in. And then when I remember Nixon going up the steps of Marine One, and it seemed very emotional and like a big deal that he was leaving the White House. And I remember, you know, his wife and family, Pat Nixon, going along with him. And I just, it stirred emotion in me that it was a historic moment. And something about that appealed to me. The idea of covering history really appealed to me. So I think that when I got to college, I can't say I was particularly academic as a high school student. So I went to St. Lawrence, which is a wonderful, small liberal arts school in upstate New York, way upstate, like right near Canada. And I guess because of that interest in politics, I decided to major in politics. I was not terribly driven at that point in my life. I liked to, you know, have fun, and I liked college, and I liked the parties, and I liked living in this small town in upstate New York and sort of soaking all of that up. I studied abroad in my junior year in Austria, in Vienna, which was really, I think, kind of an awakening academic moment for me. I was studying a lot of art history and international politics on that semester. And it really is a moment that I look back on and think, that's when I started to really care about what I was learning, what I was studying, the world around me. So I'm grateful for that experience because it ignited a seriousness in me that I did not have before that in terms of academics. So that was an important moment. And then I was a minor in theater up there, and I had some really great theater professors. I always loved the theater, always loved going to the theater. My mom and dad would take us to shows. And so I had a bit of an acting bug at that point as well. So I was doing some performing then. And that was a really something I was very interested in at that point too. So it was all political science, writing, and theater. And then I worked as a bunch of different restaurants actually over those years. And then I also got a job at Corporate Finance Magazine, which was just a little like a trade publication. And that was my side job. And I was a researcher for them. And while I was there, I started to just kind of re-enjoy the process of editing and writing and telling stories and all of that. So I eventually was offered a job there as just sort of an entry-level reporter at this financial magazine. And I decided at that point that I was going to, you know, make that turn to journalism, which in my mind seemed to be about telling stories, which I loved, whether it was theater or political science or Nixon and Watergate. It seemed to scratch that itch of wanting to tell stories. And also, I loved writing, and I loved the process of editing and paring it down. And so I took a job with Corporate Finance Magazine. And, you know, then I guess that was the beginning of my career in journalism.
We're talking to Martha McKellum. When we come back, we'll ask her how it was she joined Fox News Channel in 2004. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasul. We're with Martha McKellum. From 91 to 96, she was a business news correspondent and anchor for the Wall Street Journal Report. And then from 1997 to 2003, she was a reporter/anchor for NBC CNBC. All right, 2004, how was it you joined Fox News Channel?
So I was at CNBC at the time and working. I worked on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange as a reporter, anchored a show on Homeland Security, covered 9/11 at CNBC. So really significant part of my early career and a lot of growth in those days because I was a reporter. And then they also had me anchoring at CNBC as well. And then got a call. My agent got a call from Fox saying, we would love to talk to Martha. And initially, I was, you know, very happy where I was. And at that point thought, you know, I would probably spend the rest of my career at NBC. But the talks that I had with Fox were really intriguing to me and really sparked an interest in crossing over. So at that point, I decided to kind of bite the bullet and make the move from NBC over to what at that time was, you know, a scrappy upstart of Fox News. They were doing well, but and certainly they were finding an audience. And I think that, you know, obviously the founders realized, Rupert Murdoch realized that there was a big gap out there in terms of, you know, the sort of center right part of the country that didn't feel that there was a home for them in the news business. So I came in 2004 with sort of like an undesignated, you know, I was hired as a reporter anchor, but no particular home on the channel at that point, which was great. And, you know, worked my way up. I remember that first November election for in 04, I said, look, I just want to cover the presidential election. I will stand on the street corner and, you know, talk about the cars that are, you know, driving into Boston. I'll play any role you want, however small, but I just would love to have a piece of this action covering this this presidential election. So I was assigned actually to be one of three reporters on the floor of the convention in Boston that year. It was me and Major Garrett and Carl Cameron, who was our White House reporter for a really long time. And it was so exhilarating. And I worked really hard to make sure that those live reports from the floor were juicy and thoughtful. And I guess it made an impression. I've been covering presidential elections for Fox ever since.
All right. Speaking of politicians, how do you prepare for a high-stakes interview with a politician?
So I think it starts, you know, when you're doing these big events, and I think of, you know, the town halls that Brett Baer and I do, or the debates that we've prepared for, and election night coverage, convention night coverage, all of it. I think when it's a one-on-one with someone who is either running for president or in the presidency or vice president, all of which I've had the honor of covering over the years, you start with a pretty big list. You know, I think, okay, I'm going to break this down, you know, war, foreign policy, the economy at home. And then I start thinking about the things that I wish other people were asking that person. And focusing them. I'll usually throw out, you know, a couple of text messages to people that I admire and say, you know, what would you ask? So it's a conglomerate of pulling all of those things together. And then, you know, you have, for instance, I, you know, just recently did this last week with Vice President Vance, and, you know, you have 15, I always try to come up with 10 really good questions, because usually the time frame is like, we're going to give you 15 or 20 minutes with this person. And then you have to start getting rid of stuff because the list is always a little bit too long. And what you want is to know where you want to go so well that you really don't have to look at the things that you have written down in front of you, and you can let the conversation breathe, because it may take you in a direction that you didn't know it was going. And if you're not listening, as you well know, Jack, you're going to miss that follow-up. If you're just plowing through, this is my next question, listening is the most important part of interviewing people. So I feel like I really do my homework, get all my background, think about the things I want to ask, and kind of bake that into my cake in my head. And then I go in there and start asking questions and see where it goes.
When a guest won't answer the question, Martha, what do you do?
You have to go back around it again. You have to say, okay, but this is what I asked you. And, you know, a third time if necessary. And the back and forth to me is that, you know, the viewer is going to notice if the person doesn't answer the question. And certainly I've noticed. So you give them the opportunity, say, you know, well, actually, this is what I asked. go back around again. And then I usually go back around at least a third time, maybe a fourth in some cases. But if they refuse to answer the question the way that you framed it, what has happened is that the viewer sees that. The audience sees that. They know that this individual is skirting this question, and that in and of itself tells them something as well. And that, again, raises an avenue of questioning that I might go off on, you know, sort of a side road to try to get back to what we're focusing in on. So I think, you know, it's that process of keeping them as focused to your question as possible. Politicians are great at sort of figuring out a few different talking points that they want to make and trying to get to them and go back to them. But, you know, we're there to sort of open new light and shed new light on these answers from these powerful people. And that's what we're trying to do.
If you want to learn more, www.foxnews.com. I've admired you for a lot of things. One of the many is you have a great combination of steel and velvet. How do you blend those two?
Well, thank you for saying that. I think it's just, I think you have to be true to who you are. And I think I do have, we all have sort of our lines of what we think is crossing the line and not crossing the line. But I think my goal is always to be fair with someone and to press them on the things that, you know, are obviously the question, and not to get overly personal, but to allow them to, you know, understand that I'm determined to get the answer, not because I don't like them or because I want to get them, but because it's important. And I think back on a number of interviews I did with John Kirby during the Biden administration, who was, I give credit to, you know, I know John, I like John, but he was willing to come on and he was willing to take the hard questions about what was going on, particularly in foreign policy in the Biden administration. And, you know, we got into it a lot, but there was always a level of respect there. And that's where I want to live. That's the place that I think is fair. And that's why I think that people do continue to come back on to my interviews, because it's not personal. It's about illuminating an issue of crisis, something historic that's happening in the country. And I think they know that I respect them.
We're talking to Martha McKellum, famous for The Story Goes On. When we come back, the story will continue and go on. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula. We're with Martha McKellum, the author of Unknown Valor, a story of family courage and sacrifice from Pearl Harbor to Iwo Jima, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Martha, you've covered a wide range of stories over the years. What's the most memorable story or interview you've ever had?
It's a tough one because there really are so many, but, you know, one of the things that I love more than anything is covering these huge moments in history. And I just had the privilege of doing that in Rome, covering Pope Francis's funeral. And I think it's an opportunity as a journalist and as someone who follows these stories closely. I'm Catholic. I follow the church and the history of the church as closely as I can as well. So to have the opportunity to be covering a story like that and incorporate the things that I've learned over the years. This is one of the great things about getting older, because you get a little bit of wisdom along the way. And to bring in history, the Bible, the stories of the Bible, Peter, you are my rock, and on this rock I will build my church. That is the story of the popes and the history of the popes and the passing of the pope and a conclave that follows it, that is that continuous line from Jesus and his best friend, Peter. So I love the moment of being able to incorporate all of those things to bring meaning. And I remember when the popes, when the casket was going by in the white vehicle, the Colosseum, I talked about the persecution of Christians inside that ancient Roman building, which was one of the pinnacles of the Roman Empire, and Christians being thrown to the lions, being torn apart by gladiators. And here you had the Pope, the church surviving for thousands of years, going by in this procession. And this procession was very unusual because Pope Francis was buried at St. Mary Major, when most of the popes are buried, obviously, at the Vatican. So it gave them this opportunity to weave through the streets of Rome. And I remember someone else saying to me years ago, you know, when you stand up on the rooftop of the Vatican and you look out, you think about the perseverance of the church in the wake of all of this history, world wars, Roman Empire falls, and the church is still there, even though there have been dogged efforts across history to end it, to quash it, to make it go away, because it was a powerful force in people's lives, and it led to wars at times as well. So that, to me, is just one of the most extraordinary experiences. I felt that way as well, covering Queen Elizabeth's funeral. Obviously, she had a huge historic impact over all of the 7 decades of her reign as Queen Elizabeth II. And I found her to be a fascinating historic figure. She had, you know, spoken and had weekly conversations with, I think, 14 prime ministers. I might be a little off on that number. And so many U.S. presidents. She'd seen so much. And having watched those stories really my whole life, my mom was always very interested in the history of England and Scotland and Ireland, so which our family is largely from. So those moments, I truly pinch myself, Jack. The fact that because if I wasn't sitting there covering it, I would be at home watching every single second on TV and thinking about what I would say if I could be on. So those are pretty special for me.
Okay, let's go back to May 8th, 2025. It's 1:50 in the afternoon, and there's white smoke. And Cardinal Robert Prevost, an Augustinian father from the south side of Chicago, Martha. What are your thoughts?
It was extraordinary. I did not expect white smoke at that moment. I was actually... That was the day that I interviewed Vice President Vance that morning, and I was hoping we were going to get to air the whole interview with him, but I also was very conscious of the fact that we were waiting for smoke, and I thought, oh, it's probably going to be, in fact, I said to J.D. Vance, you know, I'm kind of hoping we don't get a pope today because I really want to play your entire interview, and he, of course, is Catholic as well, so we were like, well, we'll see what happens, but that afternoon, I was in the office that I sometimes use in D.C. when I'm down there doing the show down there that day, and I saw the white smoke, and literally, Jack, my heart just started pounding because it's an extraordinary moment when you look at history, as we just talked about. So then, you know, I ran to a booth because they were going to take me live to do some commentary on it in the 2 o'clock show. And so we're waiting for who it is. And I'm shuffling through my notes of the people that we think it might be, Cardinal Parolin, Cardinal Urdu. Of course, I actually had just been in Rome with Cardinal Dolan. And he is one of my personal favorites because, you know, we love him in New York. So, you know, just watching all these people wondering what's going to happen. And, you know, this is a real lesson because everyone always says, oh, well, it'll never be an American pope. So, of course, be always ready for the shock and the surprise because this decision almost always surprises everyone. From John Paul II coming from Poland, Francis from South America. So I couldn't believe it when they were saying the name. And I also think, I thought about this after, I thought, boy, nobody does reality TV better than the Vatican. I mean, talk about building suspense. It was extraordinary. So the Swiss guards start marching in. You have this band in these little blue suits, and they're playing, you know, trumpets and trombones, and they're walking in, and you're looking up at this balcony, and the curtains have parted. Then the cardinal who comes out to make the announcement walks out. We know he's going to say this person's name, their given name, their birth name first. Roberto Francesco Prevost. I'm shuffling through my screen. Okay, Prevost. Oh, my goodness. It is an American. I couldn't believe it. And I thought my iPad was about to die. So I'm searching around for my plug to try to jam it in to make sure that I'm not going to lose my source of information in front of me while we're talking about it. But it's absolutely an extraordinary moment. And then to watch him walk out, and the whole world is watching as we try to get a handle on who this person is, because we knew very little about him. And he is, you know, soft-spoken. He spoke in Italian, not in English, I thought it was wise on his part, if I can be so bold, as to not speak English in that moment, to show that he really is a man of the world. And I think that's why he was chosen in many ways, because he has spent 30 years as a missionary in Peru, but born in Chicago. And I think the word that he has said the most so far is peace. And right away he said, peace be with you, which yes. Of course is what Jesus said to the apostles, I leave you peace. So it's extraordinary. I'm still getting used to it. I'm still, you know, reading and watching everything I can. I watched on Sunday the first homily that he gave at St. Peter's at his inaugural mass. So it's a really extraordinary time, and I'm excited about seeing what the impact is of the first American pope.
He's an Augustinian father.
Yeah.
And those priests, of course, came from St. Augustine in 400. Mm-hmm. St. Augustine said a lot of famous things. Maybe the most famous is, quote, "You have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you." Martha, is that true?
Oh, I think it is, Jack. It's one of my favorite quotes of St. Augustine. I think it's everyone's. And the idea that, you know, most of us, I know I walk around pretty restless most of the time, lots of things on our minds, looking for the ability to just trust and be at peace. And I think when the Pope said that, I think all of us just breathed kind of a sigh of relief. And it's my goal as a Catholic to find that peace, to rest in him, and to trust. And our hearts are restless until they rest in him. It's something we know, and it's a goal to always strive towards. But, you know, he's Augustine. He touches so many Americans, right? Like all of my Chicago friends are sending me, you know, T-shirts from the high school he went to and the football team, what impact it's going to have on them. You know, everybody wants to know, is he a White Sox fan or a Red? Or is he a White Sox fan? So all of that. And so for us, my daughter went to Villanova. My husband went to Villanova. Mm. So for the Villanova community, it was just, they're elated by this association. So I think everybody sort of wants a little piece of Pope Leo that they can feel a connection to. And I just think it's going to be really interesting to see what the impact is on the Church in America. Now that we have someone who gets us, who understands the struggles and the successes of the American Church, which has grown a little bit over the last couple of years. The numbers of Catholics has increased for the first time in a while since 2023 when they last checked. So I think it's going to be incredible to cover this papacy.
We're talking to Martha McKellen. If you want to learn more, www.foxnews.com. When we come back, we'll go back 84 years. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR.
You've been listening to your inspirational fireside chat, Anything Is Possible, for nearly 20 years.
This is Anything Is Possible, and I'm Jack Rasula.
But what has Jack been up to lately? Search at AIP Speaker Series and find out. Jack has interviewed thousands of historical voices, some of whom have offered him their philosophy of life, like Tom Izzo.
And Tom writes, "Work hard, persistence always wins out, discipline is the highest form of love. Stay humble."
The great Ernie Harwell.
"My aim is to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with God."
And the voices of our generation.
"I am reassured continuously that his unfathomable love and mercy are the greatest gifts of my life, and my constant source of strength, reassurance, and guidance. His Holiness, Pope Francis."
At AIP Speaker Series is the YouTube channel where all of these jewels can be heard, including some of Anything Is Possible's greatest guests.
And we're with Mitch Albom.
The Little Liar is really a book about truth and lies and the price we pay when we lie.
This is Anything Is Possible, and with Tom Watson.
My father loved to play with the pros at the club. Developed a very quick friendship with Stan and played some golf with him. And then he would ask me to play golf with him and Stan.
Our guest this week was born with a rare disorder characterized by the absence of arms and legs. His name, Nick Vujicic.
Something that every human being actually deals with, Jack. It's the choice of continuing to believe or giving up.
And recordings of the AIP Speaker Series events at St. John's Resort. Go to YouTube and search at AIP Speaker Series. It's free. And remember,
anything is possible.
Spohom. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Martha McKellum. Martha, let's go back. December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor. You wrote a book, Unknown Valor. Talk to us about the story of family, courage, and sacrifice from Pearl Harbor to Iwo Jima.
Well, it started, Jack, with letters that my mom shared with us when we were growing up. And her cousin, her first cousin, as I said, she was an only child. So her first cousins were basically like her siblings. And she was very close to her cousin Nancy and Nancy's brother Harry. And then Harry went off to fight in World War II at the age of 18. And he wrote a lot of letters home. And my grandfather, Harry's father had passed away. So my grandfather was really like a dad to him in many ways. And they wrote to each other a lot. And in fact, these letters opened up this relationship. And it was so moving to me to see these letters that this young man wrote home about not wanting anyone to worry about him and where he was and what he was seeing. And, you know, to know that that last letter was received by my Aunt Anne, his mom, after he was killed on his first trip sort of up to the front lines on Iwo Jima was so heartbreaking to me. I would always tear up when I read this letter, just knowing that this wonderful mom and wonderful person who I knew received this letter after she knew that her son had passed. So I started digging into this story, and then I decided I wanted to write about it and I wanted to learn more. I knew almost nothing about Iwo Jima except that it was a battle in the Pacific. And as soon as I started writing it and I read these other individuals, George Coburn, who had also written a letter to my Aunt Anne, you know, saying I was with Harry on Iwo Jima and he lived in a nearby town. So these characters started to emerge from this story, other people that Harry talked about in his letters. And so I started digging and trying to find them. And it was an incredible experience. I found George Coburn, who I thought had passed away. I found him alive and living in Florida. And when I contacted him, I said, hi, you know, this is Martha McKellum. I am Harry Gray's grandniece. And he said, Martha, I think about Harry Gray every single day of my life. And he just broke down. And so we developed this friendship. George is an incredibly kind man. He told me all these stories about the two of them. He was there when the mortar hit that took Harry's life. And so it was really the most emotional journey that I could ever have anticipated. And I ended up finding this other character, Dominic Grassi, who was the cousin of another friend of mine, because she said, oh, you know, she's my friend's mom. I also had a cousin who was killed on Iwo Jima. And, you know, it just like the circles kept getting smaller and smaller. And I wrote about Dominic's story. He had been recruited by the New York Giants to play football, but he wanted to go right off after college in Buffalo to serve in World War II in the Pacific. And he also did not make it back. And although they didn't know each other, Dominic Grassi and Harry Gray, I found the manifest that sent their bodies home on this ship. And the two individuals that I came to know and love came back on the ship right next to each other, their bodies alphabetically arranged on the ship on their way back home to upstate New York and to Worcester, Massachusetts. So I got to go to Iwo Jima. I went to Guam. I went on a plane. Delta every year takes a few veterans and some friends and reporters over to Iwo Jima, which is not easy to get to. You go to Tokyo, to Guam, to Iwo Jima, hours and hours of flights for each one of those legs. But Iwo Jima is just a tiny island. You can walk the whole thing in an afternoon. I went up to Mount Suribachi. I saw the field where Harry was killed and got to experience it with veterans who were there. So it was just honestly one of the most gratifying and moving experiences of my life writing that book. So I'm really grateful that I had the opportunity to tell their story.
Unknown Valor, a story of family courage and sacrifice from Pearl Harbor to Iwo Jima. Martha, in 36 grueling days, we lost nearly 7,000 Marines, killed 22,000 were wounded in Iwo Jima. So, the greatest generation, the greatest generation.
Absolutely.
Okay, speaking of the greatest, arguably your most important role is being a mom to your two sons and daughter. We just had Mother's Day a couple weeks ago. What is a mom, Martha?
Well, you know, I think a mom is, first of all, the person that brings you into the world. Like, you're of each other, made of each other. And it's the most intense relationship I think any of us have. I know when I lost my mom, it was so difficult. She died at 78 of breast cancer. And, you know, sometimes your relationship, sometimes your mom's the person who points stuff out that you don't necessarily want to point it out. And she's the person who loves you more than anyone in the world. It's the most special relationship. And, of course, we have, you know, Mary's example, all of us to strive for.
Martha McKellum, thank you very much for all you do. And most importantly, for the manner and the style with which you do it. Keep up the great work.
Jack, thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Please join us next week. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.
Believe